Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this, what is today, Wednesday, the 11th of March. Tomorrow, Tom Hayden is going to be speaking at the UW-Milwaukee Zalazo Center at 7 o'clock in the evening, and he is with us this hour to talk about a variety of issues, Iraq and Afghanistan and the economy and the National Endowment for the Arts, and the list goes on. He's been a political activist for a long time now, since the 1960s. He, some have said, changed America, created the blueprint for the Great Society programs. He was the single greatest figure of the 1960s student movement, according to a New York Times book review. He was one of the Chicago Eight, along with Abby Hoffman, Bobby Seale, Dave Dillinger. Tried for conspiracy, you'll recall that if you were alive during the time following the 1968 Democratic National Convention protests. Tom also was a state senator in California for a number of years, where he's been called the conscience of the California Senate. He has written a number of books. He has been very active in getting people to pay attention to what's going on in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and also the economy. He writes for The Nation and a number of other publications, and we're happy to have him with us this hour. Our phone number, as we go from subject to subject, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Tom Hayden, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, good morning.
Yeah, nice to have you here. Let's start with Afghanistan, Tom. What do you think about the president's plans to put more troops there? How will we know if we've done anything? What should we be doing there, if anything?
Well, I'm glad that your Senator Feingold held off support or expressed doubt. I think it's strange to add 17,000 more troops and then say you're doing a review of your policy. I think you should have the policy first. So I suppose he's going to escalate, and whether it becomes a Vietnam, who's to know, but just to put something in perspective, I think the reason it's hard to believe in a military solution to anything in that country is that we keep engaging on bigger battlefields against more people with fewer troops. Afghanistan is bigger than Iraq, and at most we'll have 50 or 60,000 troops there. We had 160,000 in Iraq. Pakistan is much larger than anyone imagines, and we've got a secret war, you know, going in Pakistan. So it's inconceivable that, to me, that's inconceivable that there's a military approach that's going to work.
So what approach would work? What approach do we need?
Well, this is the last of, hopefully, the last of the Bush wars that he has to wrap up. I think you're going to have to negotiate your way out, and that's going to involve pulling back American ground troops, who are the sole reason or the primary reason that unifies the nationalist resistance there. They should be back to bases, or there should be a plan for their withdrawal in a rapid period of time. You've got to talk with Iraq, which I think is happening, because Iraq shares that big, big border, and Iraq was on the American side not so long ago in Afghanistan. And you have to take on the fact that this is the 125th poorest country in the world by the UN charts out of like 127.
Really?
Yes. And in Pakistan, it's hardly better. I've seen data that says 60% of Pakistan's kids are stunted or extremely stunted. So those are factors that we always talk about but do little about. And if I were to add something to the grand picture, I think that getting out of Iraq and recognizing a Palestinian state as soon as possible would do more than anything to deflate the momentum and the rage in the Muslim world, including Afghanistan and Pakistan.
I know you've had praise for George Mitchell being appointed as an envoy to that region. What gives you hope about him?
I saw a lot of George Mitchell during the period that he was negotiating between the various parties in Northern Ireland. Mm. And I thought that he did a great job of being an empathetic, neutral, and sometimes a tough guy in negotiations, sort of like the Senate leader that he was before that. He has those skills, and I think that the Palestinians would want to have some trust in him. We'll see what happens. The really shocking and unfortunate thing that happened in the last day or two is Obama's very good appointee to that intelligence slot, Charles Freeman, former ambassador to Saudi Arabia, has apparently been booted out or withdrawn over pressure from AIPAC and elements in the Jewish community, perhaps the Israelis too, I don't know. But he was probably the best of the president's appointees because he was a critic of Israel. He was an American diplomat. He knows the region, and he would have been seriously objective and straight talking within the councils around Obama, and he's been pushed out before he got a chance to begin doing his job.
You mentioned Northern Ireland, Tom. You want to comment on what happened there over the weekend? Do you think the country's on the brink of an abyss again, or is
I'm trying to find out. You could view it as isolated incidents, but it's three in a row.
Yeah.
What happened is that the armed movement among the Irish nationalists and Catholics has always been strong, and it goes through periods of ebb and flow. But it really looked to me like they had chosen deliberately the political path to a solution in stages by which Irish Catholics in the north, Irish nationalists, would be allowed to practice their beliefs, practice their political loyalties in absolute equality, or as they say, parity of esteem, with the Unionists and the Loyalists. There was one faction of the Republican movement, or the IRA, that was very unhappy with this point of view, thought that the British still had to be pushed out by force from the region, and they were quite marginalized because people were extremely happy with the peace process, and now it's 10 years later, they've come back. I don't know if they have any political support from the public, but they have a capacity to not only shoot and kill, but to maybe trigger a response from the other side, and then we're back on. I think it's rather unlikely, but there's definitely a simmering resumption of violence there, sure.
Let's go back to Pakistan for a moment. There's so much to cover in the world. What is the secret war we're carrying on in Pakistan?
Well, it's secret in name only. I mean, we know that it's reported as a secret war. There's 100 U.S. special operatives in Pakistan using Predator missiles. That's a missile delivered from the air. Predator missiles against groups that are thought to be Al-Qaeda or be jihadists. And each time this occurs, Pakistan officially condemns it. And villagers say that a lot of innocent people are being killed and hurt. So who's to know? It's very difficult for reporters to get in there. We're also spending we've budgeted $400 million for a tribal counterinsurgency that is called the Frontier Corps, and about 50 or 60,000 tribes are being paid to go after each other, go after Al-Qaeda, go after the allies of the Taliban. So it's a secret war, but the effect of it politically is to rile huge anti-American sentiment across Pakistan, a very unstable country, and one where, you know, the government may fall, and it's a strategic interest of the United States because of the nuclear weapons there. I think it's the most unstable situation that we have gotten ourselves into, and we say that's because it's used as a base area for attacking Afghanistan, but of course we use Pakistan as a base area ourselves. So I prefer to think of it as one war, Afghanistan-Pakistan. And it's largely fought in areas that are called Taliban areas, but they're really the tribal areas of the people known as the Pashtun in southern Afghanistan, and they cross over into southern Pakistan. Those lines were drawn by the British, and if you inflame Pashtun nationalism, you have for yourself potentially a very long war, I'm afraid.
Tom Hayden is our guest this hour. We're going to take phone calls in just a moment, 800-486-8655. Tomorrow he'll be speaking on a wide range of topics at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee at 7 o'clock in the evening. The event is free and open to the public. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Did I give you the number? 800-486-8655. We also have an email address you can use, and that is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Tom Hayden, starting with Karen in Platteville. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Well, while you're fighting the battle against Vietnam, I'm in the Air Force at headquarters USAFE in Wiesbaden, and I had a peace symbol in my car, and no one made me take it off, even though it was parked at headquarters. Otherwise, a friend of mine ended up in the Hanoi Hilton. And then years later, while my daughter was attending UW-Madison Law School, she was on a trip to Vietnam and actually toured the Hanoi Hilton. So my question is, who was the bigger influence, you or, I mean, who was the biggest influence on you? Or Jane?
Who's the influence on me?
Right, because you're called the overall leader of the anti-Vietnam era. And so the question is, was Jane a bigger influence on you, or was there someone else?
Well, I think we acted pretty equally towards each other. The influences on me, I think, were basically my experience in growing up in Michigan, discovering civil rights and poverty issues, and seeing that not very much was going to be done about it unless you went to demonstrations and you got involved. And then we discovered, instead of dealing with those issues at home, we were sending 150,000 people to Vietnam in 1965, after President Johnson basically said that he wouldn't send American boys to a land war in Southeast Asia. And so I think the shock that that the government would lie and that it would use human life like that, just I think people forget many of us could be drafted but not vote. That made more of a radical out of me. As to reading, I always was more of a philosophical guy. You know, the Greeks, the people that raised the big questions. But it was my experience that drove me more than anything else.
Yeah, do you mind
talking? What time is it out there in Wiesbaden?
It's 10:22.
All right.
comment was that back in when Kissinger or when Kennedy or sent 10,000 men to Vietnam, I was kind of in a state of shock because I thought it took an act of Congress.
Those were put in. I don't think it was 10,000. I think it was 1,700. But they were put in, as an executive action, and they were considered trainers. So it was not. He thought that it didn't require a consent from the Congress, and from there it grew.
Thanks very much for the call. I am interested in hearing you talk, Tom, a little bit more about your time in the Deep South, your time as a freedom writer. You suffered arrest. I think you were even beaten in Georgia, weren't you?
Yes. Yes, yes. Long ago.
Long ago.
But I think the experiences you have when you're 18 or 20 or 22 are formative, and they last your whole life. So you had, on the one hand, the liberal education growing up in Michigan. My family was also from Wisconsin, versus the reality in Mississippi, which couldn't have been more in your face.
Mm-hmm.
Racism, violent, and it just made you wonder, you know, what were we? And you came to the conclusion that life in America is kind of a contradiction. You have all these freedoms on the one hand, but the freedoms were based on the exclusion of others, the enslavement of others, and the destruction of the native cultures at the very foundation of the country. So we we have a great democracy on the one hand, but it's founded on an original sin.
I was I actually couldn't get enough of watching John Lewis during the election of President Obama, and I don't want to get stuck on that moment, but it is true that what he went through, what you went through, it wasn't all that long ago, was it, Tom? And to see the tears just pouring down his face every time he tried to talk about all of this, it was so moving.
Yeah, I think I have the same feelings, and I think it just comes from, you know, this notion of what is the syndrome called? The post-traumatic stress affects people that went through the South and went through the anti-war movement, went through some of the 60s. Horrors, the assassinations at home. It's not just something that arises from a battlefield out there in other countries. And so you find yourself catching yourself emotionally, and your voice is checked, and you find yourself shedding tears out of your control, kind of. It just wells up.
Mm-hmm.
And this would not be the case for the younger generation. I'm speaking at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee tomorrow and Friday. They've had a very different experience. But if you went through, say, Mississippi or some experience like that long enough, you would have very deep emotion about the emergence and the election of Barack Obama, because in those days it was like you could imagine a Barack Obama in the future, but it was a criminal desire because love and pregnancy and raising children between a black and a white person was against the law in much of the country. And he was born at the time of the 1963 march on Washington, where it was a time of high hope for getting rid of those conditions. And so when, you know, he says he wants to be distant and separate from the 60s, I think that's true. He's only 47 years old. And yet he also admits and says that he's a pure child of the 60s. We know what he means.
Right.
He comes from us.
Yeah. Bill is from Oshkosh is next. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Wonderful show. I've missed part of it, but perhaps your guest knows a bit more about Afghanistan and Pakistan than a lot of our experts do. But first, a comment on the great irony, I think, as you mentioned earlier, that we defeated the Indians, American Indians, and took away their homeland, et cetera, with all kinds of rationales that were very high and mighty. And the irony is that we're getting whipped in some ways by tribals in Afghanistan and Iraq, or at least having very serious problems with them. And my question is, given the amount of expertise that we have in America, both on tribal societies, but certainly on Iraq, and people have done research there with tribal societies, Baluchistan, I mean, all through the area, the principles are quite similar. And we've seen movies, even in the popular culture, Khyber Pass and whatever, and we know that the SWATs were extremely tough, and all those people are a real handful to deal with, and you know, the British certainly had their hands full, as did the Russians. Why is it it's so slow for Americans, well, at least for the policymakers, to pick up on that expertise or that cultural knowledge? I think it's a great contradiction, like you mentioned before, about the Vietnam War. And I was wondering if you'd had some insights. I do know that Rumsfeld, at least I never saw it disavowed, refused to let people go to the post, the planning conference before the war with AID, U.S., CDC, et cetera, about how to govern or rehabilitate Iraq following the invasion. And Rumsfeld apparently refused to let anybody from the Pentagon to go there. But it's this blindness to those meetings. And we had a bunch of experts. We governed Japan, Philippines, and Germany following the wars, but we completely bungled this one in so many ways. But my question is really about, why don't we understand the kind of complex, layered situation we get into? It's all around the Near East, from Cairo to Kuwait, as they used to say, but also in Libya, and the tribals are very active there still. Anyway.
Tom?
Well, it's a very good question. The short answer, I think, is it's extremely difficult because it goes to the heart of American identity. There's a preference, I think, psychologically and culturally, to think that America is some sort of immaculate conception. The first colonizers came and they didn't really see people. They thought it was a vast wilderness and empty continent, and where the Indians appeared, they seemed like non-entities. Savages in a savage land was the way it was described. So to go into that starts to raise questions about the legitimacy of American nationhood and how we were formed. And people prefer to think of us as, the first democracy, the city on the hill, the beacon to the world, the chosen people, and so on. So that's the short answer on that. But I do think it's true. You left out Latin America and Bolivia in particular. It's true that the so-called Indians are still here. They're all around us. And this blindness about our own past does, I think, deflect attention away from how to handle the tribes in Chiapas or the people in Nicaragua or the people in Bolivia and the other countries that you've mentioned. Yet, it's been a long time, and there's been a growth curve, and I do think, quite a number of people are very sensitive to these issues and have different approaches than military ones to how to handle it. The Obama administration has yet to weigh in on what they're going to do about the United Nations so-called millennial program that provides drinking water, primary education, the rest of it to the 1 billion or 2 billion people that live in extreme poverty. I think that if we created a living wage here in our locales, we should be able to create a living wage standard in the world that's enforceable. That would probably do more to lessen violence than sending in Predator missiles. And I'm feeling that President Obama might be open to these arguments, but there first has to be arguments. There has to be a peace movement. There has to be congressional hearings. And I hope that you ask your senators and congresspeople in Wisconsin to push for hearings. What the hell are we doing in Afghanistan? What is the end game? What is the exit strategy? What are we doing in Pakistan besides destabilizing it further? What is the plan there? Even Secretary Gates, the defense secretary, says there's no military solution. He says that. Obama says that. And then the neoconservatives over at the American Enterprise Institute say that they're wimping out, that the solution is military victory, not diplomacy. So you have an active neoconservative and right wing that is oblivious to, apparently, to the previous election. They're carrying on, and I think it's up to the peace movement and members of Congress to open space on the progressive side of the spectrum.
Thanks, Bill, very much for the call. Let's go to Sacramento for a minute. What are we doing with tent cities in this country? One that's been making the news a lot the last couple of days is in Sacramento, Tom.
I don't know. I think it's an honorable tradition. It goes back to the beginnings of the New Deal, the Great Depression, and the beginning of the 30s. And we're in, an extreme recession, depression, and people are trying to make some kind of stand for themselves in public space, in the streets, in tent cities. Students have tried it in a few places, and it may catch on. I don't know.
I know that you've also written, I think, recently in The Nation, this week in The Nation, you talked about Obama's senior economic positions, your concerns that he has filled these with people directly responsible for the deregulation policies that contributed to the unfolding catastrophe.
Well, that's true.
You want to see some changes here? Things don't seem to be moving along.
I don't know what's going on. Look, I think that his budget proposals, the Keynesian pump priming, get the money out there, attach it to future programs in education, down payment on health care, energy efficiency, that's terrific. That's a good budget, the best I've seen in many decades. But where we haven't heard an approach yet is, what are you going to do about credit? What are you going to do about banks and financial institutions? And it's clear that there's more hundreds of billions that somebody's planning to send out the door. And it's also clear that the public is extremely upset, and rightly so, against bailouts for people that created the mess in the first place with their excessive greed. And it happens that Obama has appointed a whole bunch of people who are acolytes of Richard Rubin at Citibank, his Treasury Secretary, budget person, a whole bunch of people come out of this school of thought that's taken grip for 20 years, called deregulation. And Larry Summers, the top economic advisor, is actually the person who proposed that there be no regulation of the derivatives market a decade ago. It went through Congress, and it was signed by Bill Clinton. Things were made worse by George Bush, but this is a bipartisan mess. And the derivatives market is very hard for people to understand. Mm-hmm. I got into it when I was in the Senate, and I had to go through the hearings on Orange County's financial meltdown at the time. But without being overly complicated, the idea of derivatives is they are securities that derive from some underlying asset. But these underlying assets are are chopped up devices that have been created in the subprime loans that aren't going that have no value. So there's no value under the derivatives. The market for derivatives has jumped from, I think, $100 trillion to $500 trillion estimate under Bush. So it really took off, and I don't know how the people who believed in this, created this, legislated this, are now going to turn around and say, "Whoops, we made a huge mistake." But they have to. There has to be a re-regulation of the derivatives market, a regulation of the banking system, a regulation of these financial institutions on a scale that would take you back to the 40s and 30s, I think. And short of that, I don't know what's going to happen, and yet Obama has surrounded himself with these people. And it's just impossible for me to believe that they're about to reverse course on what they have staked their careers on for the past 20 years. Maybe they will.
Let's go to Joe from Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Hi, Tom. I wonder if I could get you to compare activists from the 60s to today's activists. And how can we encourage more people to get active?
Well, there was a surplus of activists in the 60s, and there's a deficit today. But I don't know how to explain it. In the 60s, we were faced with much more upfront contradictions and problems. As I said, couldn't vote but could be drafted. And the draft for Vietnam was a permanent galvanizing oppressive pressure on each and every one, no matter how you felt about the war. And the civil rights movement was a generational movement of young people who didn't want to settle for what their parents had been forced to settle for. And the environmental movement exploded, a handful of people, Gaylord Nelson among them, produced an event, Earth Day, that had 20 million people at it. So the scale of the 60s is intimidating, I think, to anybody growing up and thinking about it. But I do think change comes in unexpected ways, and the Obama generation, the thousands, tens of thousands of people, a few of whom I know, is going to be the wellspring of the next generation of social activism for the next 20 years, I think. Obama was a presidential campaign. It was also a social movement. Mm-hmm. By that I mean there were community organizing techniques that are well known. But beyond that, it tapped into some consciousness that was already there, that was beyond, I think, what Obama and his advisors expected. And you had countless volunteers who really cut their teeth on activism by going into counties in South Carolina, in one case I know, and spending a year of their lives. And they may be taking a breather for the moment, but I think you're talking about a whole new generation of activism there that goes beyond the election of Obama, but is stimulated by the success of Obama's triumph as well. And so I'm looking at a social movement coming out of the Obama experience more than a social movement necessarily coming out of the streets. It can be both. I think people should go in the streets. I think young people should be extremely upset about having their future ripped off by this economic meltdown. Mm-hmm. But the people that we should expect energy from, whether it's inside or outside the system, I think in many cases will be the people who went through the Obama campaign at the grassroots.
And I think from what he said about the campaign, Tom, is that he sensed all of that as well, that Clinton had the money, that there were all these forces who had more than he did, but he just, there was something that he knew and that showed that people wanted something profoundly different. And he was, for whatever reason, and there are many reasons, he's a brilliant guy, he was the agent of change. He knew that early on, and it's why he's still hard to believe, but he is the president.
It is indeed. It is indeed.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe, very much for your call. Let's go to Mike from South Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
I just tuned in about 5 minutes ago, so I caught the gist of the conversation. But I'd like the guest comment about what I think is the Goldman Sachs mafia that I think is controlling the financial picture in this country, specifically Robert Rubin, John Thayne, Henry Paulson, Lloyd Blankfein, and the friends of the mafia, Larry Summers, Tim Geithner. Specifically, Lloyd Blankfein was the only person from Wall Street present where the New York Federal Reserve met to bail out AIG. And the reason AIG was bailed out is because Goldman Sachs is a counterparty to a significant amount of derivatives that AIG has invested in. And if AIG goes bankrupt, Goldman Sachs is probably going to go down the tubes.
All right, I need to hold you there because your phone is just cutting in and out. Did you get enough of that, Tom?
I did. And
all right.
I don't know if he heard me, but he's elaborating on the point that I was making. I didn't call them the Goldman Sachs Mafia, but these advisors that come out of Rubin's school of thought, Rubinomics, who deregulated the derivatives market, are the people on the Democratic side and the Republican side who are to blame. But They're in the White House. They're advisors to the president, and I'm trying to figure out how they are going to turn around on their own beliefs and practices. But I think long about April, as it warms up, you're going to see demonstrations on Wall Street. You're going to see these questions asked in Congress. And we need to go back both to re-regulation, I think, and to some sort of nationalization of some of these institutions. And it won't be a pretty picture, but I think the alternative being worse, we're headed in that direction. And there are banking systems just across the border. The Canadian banking system is a sort of a quasi-public-private network of institutions, highly regulated and relatively stable. And it's about time that we stop looking down our nose at Canada or Sweden, you know, like as if those are wimpy countries that don't take risks. And the time has come. I remember I came from Wisconsin on my parents' side, and they went through the Depression, and my grandma in Oconomowoc had 11 kids.
Oh, my.
And the grandpa was killed in an accident, an industrial accident at the Carnation Milk Company, I believe it was called. And she got a settlement of $5,000. In those days, there was no workers' comp or any of the mechanisms we have now. And so she took the 11 kids through the Depression.
Hmm.
Including my mom. And when my mother died in 84, I had to go back to Oconomowoc and clean up after what she left behind. And what startled me, the impression I had about this Depression consciousness, having gone through the 30s, she left $6,000 in three accounts in Oconomowoc, in two banks and one savings and loans, I think it was, because she was afraid to leave it in one place.
Yes, yes.
And when I went into the security vaults to get the trays, find out what was in there, what she left behind, and you open the little metal security boxes, she had intentionally wrapped everything in tinfoil in case there was a fire or something like that. And it was $6,000 in small bills, and I think there was Gerber's baby food stock, and the Wisconsin utility, what's the name of the state utility? And that was it. And that's the way she lived her whole life. Mm. She never spent an extra penny. She never missed a day's work. She was so traumatized as a kid by what they went through in the 30s. But as I grew up, it was, you know, boom, the 50s. The auto workers were getting $20 an hour in Detroit, and everybody was getting houses financed, and it seemed like the 30s were really over. But as I look at the world today, the person whose influence on me, perhaps the greatest, would be my mother. Would be what she told me, and what she, the way she lived as a result of having gone through with an experience that may come to pass in this generation's lifetime. And where's the Roosevelt? Where's the Wagner Act? Where's the health insurance? Somehow it's an opportunity for big social reform as well.
And do you think this president knows that, Tom?
Yeah.
I mean, I think he does, too. So is he trying to make the other side happy and they're never going to be happy? Is he waiting for 60 votes in the Senate or what?
That I don't know. Obviously, he positions himself in the center. He's flexible. And he's already kind of on the left end of the spectrum of the Washington scene with his spending proposals, and he's getting attacked. So he needs, the labor movement in the streets. He needs, the tent cities. He needs the rage out there that makes Washington wake up and do things. You know, it used to be in that movie, the fellow played by Michael Douglas said, "Greed is good." Now we need to say rage is good and express it because there's no other way to get the climate in which an Obama could move a bold program forward. He's certainly done some things that are positive. This appointment of Van Jones, the young African-American out of Oakland, who's a charismatic speaker and, a brilliant organizer of young people in the past few years out here, is now the new presidential advisor to President Barack Obama on green jobs, on weatherization, on insulation, on solar, on wind, and they want to make it not only a energy conservation program, but an economic development program that puts the unemployed youth from the ghettos and barrios to work on real jobs with the future. That could be the next New Deal that awaits us. My students, I teach out here in Claremont this afternoon, as a matter of fact, and when I ask them, are they worried? They say, yeah, but. They to a person seem to believe that Obama is going to find them a future, an economic future in these environmental policies.
Tom Hayden is our guest, and we'll take a few more phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I want to remind you that Tom Hayden is speaking tomorrow at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Alazzo Center at 7 o'clock tomorrow night. It's open to the public, and he'll be talking about, well, a lot of different issues. It is sponsored by the Milwaukee Students for a Democratic Society. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Ron is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Ron.
Hi there, Kathleen and Tom.
Good morning.
I actually filmed back in 1969 Jane Fonda's speech at Fort Bragg when she said, "It's not my country, right or wrong. Patriotism, true patriotism, is my country doing away with what is wrong and keeping what's right." she said it better than I did. But I wanted to ask you, Tom, how you see the the institutionalized and organized and intelligent use of military planning and budget planning and Reagan's deregulation of the free market system to make it a free-for-all, and that meant that the bullies and the planners could probably do what they want to do, and we've seen what happened. How do you see the concept of self-regulation? That's really what I'm interested in. It seems that a power like the United States can't be stopped, or the international monetary capitalist system can't be stopped unless it's willing to stop itself. And I think we live in an age of education and therapy where we learn to regulate ourselves, and I think that's what's up for the United States. What do you think about exposing the undercover works of the CIA and others who seem to be undermining so many legitimate democratic efforts of the world to regulate itself? And the bad guys, the organized crime guys, they just keep pulling tricks on us because they can.
Tom.
That's a lot. It's hard to jump from issue to issue, and I know the listeners come in and out. So let me summarize in answering this question. We're still involved deeply in the Iraq war and increasingly in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And the proponents of these wars call them the long war. They have in mind 50 years of fighting, of combat, of counterinsurgency, from the Middle East all the way over to Afghanistan and Pakistan. These are the areas where the conflict with the Muslim world and Islamic fundamentalism is greatest. They're also the areas where the oil deposits and the oil pipelines are most prominent. And they're also the areas where the greatest poverty in the world, poverty indicators, happen to be. So just in Afghanistan alone, by my estimate, if Obama spends $170 billion this year in Afghanistan, and he starts spending at that rate every year on military stuff, if you total it up, from 2001, we will have spent at least $1 trillion on Afghanistan alone by the end of Obama's first term. And I'm sure it will be higher than that because of the hospitalization costs and replacement of equipment and so on. So the question we have to ask ourselves, finally, is the one that your professor out there in Wisconsin, William Appleman Williams, asked back in my time. Can we afford all this? Johnson said in the 60s, we can afford guns and butter. Can we? Can we afford a long war? Or is this indulgence in empire stripping us of the resources we need for health care and for education? I think that issue has come around again. And The question that you ask about the whether the banking and financial system is simply self-interested and needs to be radically reformed is a good one. How are we going to create investments, private and public, in this country and go along with this concept of a long war? I don't think that we can do both. As far as self-regulation, there should be no misunderstanding. We need re-regulation of the classic sort right now. However, the root problem here, I think, that we have, as distinct from Canada, from Scandinavian countries, European countries, is that we place too narrow an emphasis on the maximization of profit as the sole standard of performance for shareholders and for a company. And we need a debate on how to create a quality of life standard that takes into account profit, of course, but also the total impact of economic decisions. Bobby Kennedy raised this in, I think, the greatest speech he ever gave back in 1967, when he started to rave against the gross national product as a indicator of performance. And he said that means everything that we produce that is destroyed, every time the hospitals are filled with people, every time guns go off in the streets, the gross national product expands.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye, Tom. We're plumb out of time.
Quality of life is finished. That's the issue that I
yeah.
to address.
Thank you, Tom, so much for being with us. Tom Hayden, our guest this hour. Tomorrow he will be at UWM at 7 o'clock in the evening in the Zelazo Center. It's open to the public. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Rob Schroeder for production. This is the Ideas Network.